All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Strength Academy podcast. Grayson here, joined by Mundo.
What's up, y'all?
All right, guys, so we put out a couple of feelers on the Instagrams this week and got a few questions from you guys, and we're going to do our best at making our way through a few of those, trying to expound on some of the things you guys were asking. And yeah, so we're having a nice little mixed up Q&A show this week.
Yeah, and if you tuned in last week for the episode about volume, there was a recording error and we had some input feedback that was causing some echo. So we took the episode down, but we're going to redo that episode. We remember kind of like what we talked about. So we'll repost it and you guys will you'll get to hear that one, but not today.
And I'm going to try to switch the order of plugs. If you guys are listening, please rate the podcast. It really, really helps us out. It helps it get out to more people. So if you have time, go into your iTunes, leave us a rating. It would be very helpful.
Yeah, and follow us on Instagram at Albuquerque Strength Academy. And if you have any more questions that you didn't want to drop in the DMs for Instagram, or you didn't get a chance to email us, remember you can get a hold of us at Albuquerque Strength Academy, ASAweightlifting@gmail.com.
All right, guys. Well, let's go ahead and get into a couple of the questions. I think we'll start with Ricky's question. So Ricky asked, when do you stop pushing a strong non-weightlifting athlete to go heavier? And I think this is kind of an interesting question, because a lot of times coaches are working with so we're lucky in that we work with majority people who are strength athletes focusing on weightlifting as a sport.
Right.
But we do have an MMA fighter, and we've had other people in and out to kind of get stronger for other sports. So if somebody comes in and they want to, you know, improve, like their main sport is tennis and they need to do some strength training to kind of be more explosive and faster. What's the point of diminishing returns, do you think, on pushing an athlete? Would it be a specific number, or I'm leaning towards, I think it would be a percentage of body weight,
you know? Yeah, I think so. Like, when you get athletes that are from other sports, they're coming to you to try to build their strength base, and trying to get more explosive, trying to get more strength. And when you have to find out what exactly they're doing. So like, we have a golfer that's part of our weightlifting team, and she does strength training just like the rest of the team, but we also incorporate a lot of like twisting rotational exercises for her, because that's the plane of motion that she's most engaged in. And so for her, it's more of like, it's not a matter of when do we stop pushing strength, it's how do we tailor the strength to fit the sport that she's trying to play, or any athlete that is trying to come to us for that reason. So like Max, he's a MMA fighter and he wanted to get more mobile, stronger in certain positions. So like for jiu-jitsu, having good hip mobility, being able to wrap your legs around your opponent, being able to get into more positions where you have flexibility and your range of motion is increased, but you're also strong in those positions, allows you to provide more leverage in some of the positions that you need to hold when you're, you know, trying to lock somebody's limb in place, you know, and or if you're having your own limb trying to get locked in place, if you have more flexibility, that range of motion is going to extend further and you're going to be able to stay in the fight a lot longer.
On that point, I thought it was really interesting that he was saying that he found the stretches that we do to improve the front rack position,
right,
in the front squat and the clean, have been helping him have more range before he needs to tap in certain arm locks.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. So say, you know, we have our golfer and our fighter, which are kind of two very different ends of the spectrum, right? Sure. And we're using the same tools to improve both of their performances. So let's say, you know, if we're using the golfer example, right now as a beginner, we're still trying to build up to, you know, being able to easily do heavier squats at body weight. We're kind of still following that beginner progression. But at what point is it strong enough?
Right.
You know, so it's, I think that it has to come down to a couple things. Is how much recovery time is the training taking? So if you get to a certain point in your training and you're lifting such heavy loads that it's actually making you tired for your sport,
right,
then that's probably a pretty good indicator that you're just misplacing your attention, right? So if your performance is tanking during your in-season training, like that's obviously not a great...
Yeah, that's not a good...
It's too much.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if I had to kind of try to quantify some numbers just for kind of, you know, the main lifts, like if you're squatting 1.5 times body weight and deadlifting 2 times, that's probably, you know, a decent amount. Like if you're doing, you know, golf or these sort of things, like getting your deadlift from double body weight to triple body weight is probably going to be way more of a time investment and way more of an energy sink.
Sure.
Than it's going to be as a potential for carryover. So like having a, you know, double body weight deadlift will improve your performance from having a 0.5 body weight deadlift, right? For sure. Right. You're just going to be a stronger person. You'll have to be a little more explosive. But getting it much further than that. So if, you know, if we get her deadlifting, you know, 300 pounds, pushing that to 400 pounds is kind of like, well, I mean, why are we, what are we wasting our time with that?
Yeah. And so I see what you're saying. Like there is a diminishing return because like the idea of specializing in our sport requires a different level of dedication and effort put in than if you're trying to strengthen yourself for another sport by using our sport. So like in the case of like a golfer, you know, if she's able to back squat body weight or, you know, 1.5 times body weight and deadlift double body weight, that's plenty, I think. Like the most, when athletes do these extracurricular activities to build up themselves for their sport, like they're not trying to achieve mastery or they're not trying to get to an elite level in our sport. That's not necessarily their goal. That's not why they come to us. They're trying to get better at their sport. So the idea is to build strength that allows them to facilitate that, the use of those extra skills that they're building from ours. So that athleticism, and it's a sport that requires athleticism. Olympic weightlifting requires you to be an athlete, like to be explosive, to be, have timing, to have focus and precision in your technique. So there's a lot of factors that you can build on that will carry over into other sports. So like there's for instance the timing of a punch, the rotation of the body for a kick, the amount of balance that you have as you rotate the hips to kick, you know, an object or a target. So like there's different aspects of our sport that can build into other sports, but the whole idea isn't just to build another weightlifter, because we can do that, right? If they want to be just straight up weightlifters, we can do that. We can help them. But if they want to be the best golfer they can be, or the best MMA fighter that they can be, or the best track athlete they can be, then we're trying to build up a non-sport specific strength base. And in that, like, there's no reason to try to push a 300 pound press. Like if what would be the point of doing that? If they can body weight, press their body weight, that is a substantial milestone, I think. Like, if you can press your body weight, that's plenty. Like, you don't have to exceed that. But if you can get to that point, that means you're strong, athletic, you have a good strength base. And so, like, there's markers that we try to work around that I think have relevance to other sports. But the point is that they're specializing in their sport and they're just coming to us to build strength, to specialize more in their sport.
Yeah, and I think that that's going to change as the athlete gets better and depending on what sport they're in. So if you're, you know, I'm going to show my ignorance about football, but say you're like a lineman, right?
Right.
And your job is to basically be really explosive for 5 seconds.
Sure.
It's probably way more important to keep pushing that guy's strength numbers.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, so, you want that guy to have a huge bench because that's that same pressing motion. You're pressing somebody away from your body. You're pushing them and you're providing like that instantaneous explosion that has to happen as soon as you come off the line, the ball snapped.
Yeah. And if you think about it, it's mostly time domains, right? So the shorter the time domain your sport is, the more carryover you'll get from your strength training. So if you're a 100 meters guy, you're going to put a lot more time into building your squats, just because stronger legs will be more powerful legs.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You have a higher potential for speed there. And as that time domain stretches out, you know, so if you're a cross country or a marathon, then you definitely need to be able to do some strength work to kind of maintain your muscle mass and improve, because the stronger you are, the longer your stride will be.
Right.
But I think that if you're doing, you know, looking at ultra endurance stuff, it's maybe more like how many times, like, can we get you to do your body weight for a bunch of fives in the squat, or like a set of 10, you know, like build you up to that way. Cause you want to be, cause our time domains are really only specific to a few different sports, you know, throws, sprints, football, that sort of stuff, where it's really short burst explosive activity. When you're looking for just strength for, you know, this is where I think that, as we get more and more time in training with MMA athletes, is you got to have reserve to be explosive and bounce. But I think it might end up being more important, like, how heavy can you do reps?
Right.
You know, so like once you squat 400 pounds, maybe it's more important to work towards 300 for 10 than it is to work towards 415.
Yeah, you know? I agree with that, because like the idea is that you want to be able to do a sustained amount of work for a longer period, as opposed to just short bursts of work for, you know, short periods. And so like with weightlifting, we're doing a short burst of work in a short amount of time. But if you're building from, let's say, a 400 pound back squat to instead three sets of like 10 at a much lower percentage, then you're going to build more muscular endurance overall and have a more well-rounded general physical preparedness. So I mean, that's the idea, is like these guys, their goals aren't to clean and jerk the world record. You know, their goal is to be stronger so that they can hit an opponent harder, or hold them in place longer, wear them out a little more, or if it's in football, you know, to be explosive off the line, to be able to initiate that momentum that's required to be fast and push the opponent off balance. And in golf, that rotation of the swing, the legs, that the hip generation of power and the swing and follow through and the timing of that, like those are all sport specific things. But I think that if you can do a lot with weightlifting, and weightlifting can carry over into a lot of things. But I think that the point of pushing, so the original question was, is when do you stop pushing a non-strength athlete, right?
Yeah.
So in my short, my answer is when it doesn't benefit them anymore, when there's no benefit to continue to push them to that higher level. So like, I'm not going to require my MMA athlete to try to qualify for an AO series or qualify for AO finals or nationals. Like, that's not the goal. So the goal is to get them as strong as they can within the parameters of what's not going to affect the rest of their training and their performance when they have to have that performance.
Exactly. So. Yeah. And I think that, yeah. So in short, you know, it's, there's gotta be a point that's strong enough. I think that's going to depend on what the other sport is.
Yeah.
And also I think it'll in large part depend on how psychologically the athlete feels about, training. So if they feel like, oh, well, my squats are strong, my kicks are lethal, and I feel confident and like I'm the boss.
Right.
So that might mean that it might be more worthwhile for them to put a little extra effort or a little extra energy into the weight room so that psychologically they feel they have an edge. Right. So there's, you know, if there might be some mental performance benefit to feeling really strong and just being like, man, I know I'm one of the strongest dudes out here right now. And that feeling, like, that might be another valuable thing. So, like, it's going to be really, really variable based on the sport, the demands that they have, and then also just based on how are you thinking about training. Because if you, in your head, always tie, well, as long as I can do fives at 315, I'm always super, super strong. and I'm fast and I'm good at all this stuff. And if that's a belief that they have, then that's them kind of believing in what they're doing. So yeah, you got to make sure that you're doing the thing that makes them feel like they're getting better too.
Right. It's building their confidence in their abilities as an athlete.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that kind of can roll us into a question from Tyler, who was a visitor to the gym. How's it going, Tyler? So he asks, how do you get your athletes to buy into the programming and not to go too far outside of the program?
Right.
And I think that I've been really lucky in that a lot of my most of my athletes don't want to randomly max out
right.
in the third week of a new training yeah. program.
Yeah.
But I think that you know, some of the strategies that I use for kind of increasing buy-in is I try to have conversations with everybody that I'm training
right.
about the why behind the exercise. 'Cause a lot of times people will, like, if you put an arbitrary number down, like, okay, we're doing snatches from above the knee today, and people just think of it as, okay, we're doing snatches from above the knee 'cause coach said so. I think that that's going to lead to a lower amount of buy-in than having a conversation with your athletes saying the transition from the knee to the hip is a really important phase of this lift.
Right.
And going from the hang and doing these triples means that you're going to be tired on the third rep and you're going to have to be very quick under the bar and your technique will have to be very good for you to get that third rep. You're not going to be able to just kind of go through the motions.
Yeah.
And when people understand the purpose behind what you're doing, I think that that helps increase athlete buy-in. So like, yeah. You need to be educating your lifters. Like, if it's, man, I hate doing good mornings. Why are we doing good mornings? And then really explaining to them the role that a strong lower back plays
yeah.
in maintaining correct posture throughout the lift will help them buy into, okay, so I hate good mornings, but they're good for me, and this is for a reason,
yeah.
rather than I pulled this exercise out of a hat and gave it to somebody,
right.
you know?
Well, I think, so to answer the question, I think that buy-in has more to do with leadership than it does anything else. So a good leader will explain to you the purpose behind why something is being done. And to get you on board into that process, they have to be convincing in the idea that this is going to benefit you just as much as, you know, it benefits me to program it for you. And so the idea is that I'm not asking you to do anything that I'm not willing to do myself. And so when Grayson programs, you know, he's asking people to do these difficult things, but he also does difficult things. Him and I both still train. Him and I both still compete. We both still understand what it's like to be an athlete and to have these physical demands placed on you through your training. And we don't just throw random things in there and say, oh, just do this, or just do this because I said so. It's more of like, we want to change the position from this to this, or we want to facilitate a better transition from the knee position to the hip position, or we want to build everybody's starting to get deficient in a specific area, so we're going to add this into the training. So we can explain that, we can articulate that, we can give them the reasons behind why something is in the program. We just got through with a high volume phase for the first block of training, and there was some complaining. And complaining is, it's not the anti-buy-in mentality. It's more like, why are we doing this? This is hard. I might not be able to do this.
That's how I take it as well. Is I think that if it's complaining, it's something that's it's a misunderstanding of why,
yeah,
like a purpose, right?
Yeah. So and so it's a misunderstanding of, like, it's not hard just to be hard. It's difficult for a reason. There's a specific reason that we program these things. And so when Grayson has those conversations with his athletes, and I have those conversations with our athletes, it's more of getting them to understand that there's a reason behind why we do this. And we're not just asking you to do it because we're trying to be masochistic and watch you suffer. No, it's to watch and make sure that you grow in the adaptation that we're trying to achieve for that specific part of the process of that cycle. So it has to do, I think, with leadership, but getting your people to buy in, and this can apply to things outside of weightlifting. When you're trying to change something in your family or in your business or in your work environment, getting other people to buy into it is a byproduct of your ability to explain why it matters, why it's important, what the purpose is, and why it's important for them to have a vested interest in doing it.
Yeah, so that's why, you know, with anybody that we're working with remotely or anything like that, it's always the program. I always try to include a little paragraph write-up of this is what we're doing this week, this is the phase that we're in, and then always finishing with, please ask me questions if you have any questions.
Yeah.
Like, encouraging people to ask questions makes them feel like they're a part of the process.
Right.
And I think that that can help with buy-in. Now, I will say, it does occur to me, so we don't always struggle with buy-in as far as like, oh, why are we doing this snatch variation?
Sure.
Or do I really need to do this weight for squats? But the area that's the hardest, I think, to get people to buy into is doing the really boring stuff afterwards.
Yeah.
So buying in to the accessory work or the bodybuilding work afterwards, because I'm a big believer in doing a lot of single leg and single arm work. I think it's really important for maintaining balance and just kind of getting people to move in a way that's not just both feet straight up and down all the time. I think that's good for longevity and just performance in general. So, you know, getting people to buy in that the form you use on single leg RDLs is really important. And it's hard with that stuff because people can buy in on snatch balance, right? Because if they don't know and you explain, okay, well, if you can snatch balance a weight, that's getting you comfortable with what it's like to catch and hold that weight at the bottom.
Right.
There's a really clear, it's a one-to-one, like, this is the input, this is the output we're expecting.
That makes sense.
But with something like half-kneeling single-arm press and single-leg deadlift and, you know, rear-foot elevated split squat, especially if they're toward the end of the workout, people tend to want to, like, be done. And they just want to kind of rush through them.
Right.
And the difficult thing with that is that the carryover isn't as obvious as it is for a squat.
Right.
If you, you know, it's like, well, why would I want to squat this weight 10 times? It's like, well, don't you think it's going to be easier to clean and jerk it if you can squat it 10 times? And that's kind of a, oh, of course. Yeah, that makes sense. But
it's also a mental resilience form of training as well. Like, you have to be mentally resilient to be able to squat something 10 times, something that's 70%. Like, that's hard. It's hard to do.
But when something's hard, like you're struggling to maintain form deadlifting a 35-pound kettlebell on one leg, it's really hard to apply that same kind of attacking the accessory work. So I think that you know, being really thorough with your explanations and then just making sure that your programming meets certain things. So to get more buy-in, you got to make sure that the program is interesting enough to keep people following along.
Yeah.
Where if you're running the same 12-week training cycle 4 times a year, doing the exact same thing all the time, like, if there's not enough variety, I feel like that's when people will get stir crazy.
Sure.
And one of the things that I do there is, you know, we'll repeat a program here or there, but it's really just repeating the skeleton and everything else changes.
Sure.
I've never written a program and at the end of it said that was perfect and I wouldn't change it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So keeping your process, making sure that you're still learning. So if you're a coach and you're programming and you haven't learned anything new this week, you're wrong.
Okay.
So like, you need to be taking in tons and tons of information and whittling down different strategies, evaluating them as whether this is a bogus Instagram exercise, secrets of strength training,
or is it strength training,
or is this, you know, a legitimate thing,
right?
Or are you seeing this more often? And then start playing with those things.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to learn as a coach, your job is to be experimenting on your athletes to make them better. right? And if you stagnate in your learning, you'll stagnate in your programming and people will get bored.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, taking different times of year to work on different things, do some cycles that are really, really close to the lifts and some cycles that are a little further away, vary your rep schemes. All of that stuff helps keep people interested.
Right.
Because you could make good progress doing all I do is snatch and clean and jerk triples on Monday, and then I do lighter powers on Wednesday, and then we go heavy on Friday, and we repeat that same loop over and over again with an occasional deload, and you could probably make progress on that, but it's going to lead to burnout in people. So you got to be changing your accessory exercises up. There's 1,000 different things that you could be doing, and all of them are pretty effective. And I think that using variety to keep people interested and to keep people feeling like they're learning new things, or you put a new exercise in and we go, oh man, I never realized how weak that was.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff keeps people interested, and it shows that they're making progress in a variety of different areas.
Okay. I just want to add one last thing. You were talking about accessory work and getting people to buy in. So the way I think about accessory work is I always think about building my athleticism, and that's how I translate it to other people too, is like, the accessory work that we do is helping you to be an athlete in general. Like, so accessory work would be like things like box jumps, core work, the single isolateral training of the legs and arms, all that stuff, like good mornings, things, even squats. The way you approach all those things should be like, this is building my general athleticism. Yes, I'm using the snatch and the clean and jerk I'm using these things to get better at them. But those things also build your general athleticism. The better you squat, the better, you know, your leg strength is going to be, the more explosive you're going to be. The better you train your core, the more weight you're going to be able to hold upright in the snatch and clean and jerk. The more you train those isolateral movements, the better balance you'll have, the better body awareness. So like, these are all things, this is how I explain things to my athletes, is like, these things are building your athleticism. It's not just to make you a better weightlifter, it makes you a better athlete. So
yeah, and I think that again, it all comes down to having those conversations and keeping training interesting. And I think that, you know, what Mundo mentioned earlier, that both of us are still active participants in the sport. We're still trying to train, we're still doing hard stuff. So leading by example and letting your athletes know that they might be better than you.
Yeah.
That's fine.
That's
fine. Lots of my athletes are better than me.
Yeah, lots of them.
But they know I'm still trying to improve my lifts, right. And I'm still trying to improve my technique. And so they know if I say, you know, I want you to do 30 minutes of technique work at a light weight today, they'll have seen me do that earlier that week. And they'll know that I'm not just like arbitrarily picking things. Like it's stuff that I'm doing myself, and I think that that helps as well.
And I think one way I see it for myself is like, I may be the oldest male weightlifter in the gym, but I'm not going to let any of them outwork me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to work as hard as I can for as long as I can, and then expect my athletes to do the same. And that's really all I ask.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, you can kind of come back to, you know, does your coach need to be an amazing lifter? And
right.
No, they don't have to have, you know, gone to the nationals, and they don't have to be the strongest man in your state, but they need to have had experience in training, and any amount that you're trying to get better is a learning experience. And, you know, one of the things that I learned in the Army was, you know, don't ask people to do what you wouldn't
right.
do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for everyone on our team, I'm willing to do a lot of things.
A lot of terrible things.
So, you know, I always try to keep it in that frame. And if I stumble across something, and I'm lucky enough to be young enough to do this right now, but if I stumble across a new idea, I'm going to do it first.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see if it makes any sense to me. And then I'm going to try to apply it to other people and kind of scale that up or down depending right. on where people are at. So, yeah, I think that having conversations with your athletes, leading by example, changing up exercises enough to not feel monotonous, because weightlifting is, you know, sort of objectively very boring.
Yeah, it's two lifts. Like, what do you exactly. what do you expect, guys?
So as far as buy-in goes, I think that those are kind of the key things that you want to look for in keeping your athletes interested. And then, you know, if you do have somebody that you catch them, you come into the gym and you catch them maxing out, explaining to them why that's not a good idea right now.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, giving them enough rope to hang themselves with and then giving them a very firm, I told you so, when something doesn't work out the way that they want it to.
Right.
So yeah, I think, we can kind of, do a quick little stop with, Mark, Martinez asks, what are our maxes on snatch or clean and jerk? So we'll give those, but then maybe also include, you know, a lift that you're particularly proud of. I don't know.
Okay.
So right. In the last year, the most that I've done, actually no, these were lifetime PR. So I did a 107 snatch and I think a 130 clean and jerk. And, those took me forever to get to.
Yeah.
But I think, what I'm most happy about and what I kind of focus on in my training is that since mobility has always been my weakest link, spending a lot of time working on that and then coming back up and seeing how the lifts go.
Yeah.
And what I really kind of measure as far as my is the quality of work leading up to those maxes. But yeah, definitely unsatisfied with where those are right now. Okay. But a lift that I was very happy with was getting back up to 190 for 5 on the deadlift. And getting my pole back above 200 kilos just this last couple of weeks has been kind of the strength PR highlight of my year.
Yeah.
What are your bests and what's your highlight reel now that we're toward the end of the year? What's the coolest strength thing for you that you did? What are you happiest with?
So my best snatch in training is 93, and my best clean and jerk is 112. And I think those are pretty decent numbers considering I'm a master's lifter, and I think there's still room for improvement. I think I can push those up. Yeah, I think I can push those up. But one of the things that I'm probably the most proud of is I was able to clean deadlift a triple at 160. So that's a pretty heavy deadlift for me, and I was able to most recently back squat 140 for a triple, which matches my all-time best, and it just shows that I'm maintaining my strength even though I've had a couple setbacks in the past month. So my training leading up to Masters Nationals is going really well right now, and I'm hopefully going to try to keep that momentum, just stay injury free and just keep pushing the numbers. But I think that I can get to 100 in the snatch and maybe 120 in the clean and jerk, and that's reasonable within the realm of possibility.
We'll have to go out and lift with Mark out at out at Masters Nationals and put some of those numbers up.
Right.
All right. So let's see.
So on that subject, Tyler did bring up like kind of a funny question, like who would win in a Sinclair total lifting meet, me or Grayson? And
I think it might be you.
I think it might be me.
Yeah, pretty sure that total, I'm like three-way classes above you.
Yeah, and my best training total is 204, so.
Yeah, if we compare that to, I'm pretty sure you've got the win on the Sinclair total. We could look it up, but I'd just cry.
Yeah, let's just leave it at that. we'll just call it there.
But I think, let's see, you want to end with a couple of fun questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So, Kyle asked, very simple, science or magic? And I know that this is a joke question, but I'm going to treat it with as if it is not, because I think that it depends on what you're trying to do.
Well, isn't a high level of science and technology appear to be magical?
Yeah, so you could take that approach, right? Where right. So a sufficiently advanced technology appears to be magic if you don't know the mechanisms. Right. So smartphones would be magic to people in 1500s.
1500s? Let's just take it back 50 like years 15 ago.
15 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, a sufficient level of technology is always going to appear to be magical, right? So if the aliens come down and they can read your thoughts, it might seem like it's magic, but maybe they just have a good machine for that.
Right.
But I think that if you're looking for, you know, practicality, right? So science is going to tell you what things do. Science is a really good descriptor of the world, right? So if you're wondering, like, okay, what should my average intensity be? We can look to the science to see what the kind of average working weight should be in your sets. Or, you know, if you're trying to understand how to build more muscle, that's where science can come in. But I think where magic can come in is just where any sort of belief can come in.
Sure.
Right? So if you hold a belief to be true, right? So say, this is kind of my favorite example of practical use of magical thinking, right?
Okay.
So if you are trying to improve your psychological readiness in the gym, and so to do that, you're going to say, all right, well, I, Grayson, don't have enough intensity in the gym. But you know who brings the intensity to the gym? Batman. Batman brings intensity
Batman
to the
does
gym.
Bring intensity to
so
the
maybe
gym.
Before you go work out, you put up like 3 pictures of your Batman comics
okay.
and you light some candles and you meditate while listening to the, like the Stephen West or
Adam West.
Adam West Batman theme music,
there
right?
There you go, yeah.
And then you do that for 10 minutes and then you adopt Batman as a persona and you go to the gym as Batman.
Okay.
Right? So that's a ritual and some magical thinking where you're trying to channel a deity or channel Batman into your workout, right? You're not Batman. That's not really happening. There's no science there, right? You're not Batman.
Sure.
But you're doing something psychologically to yourself.
Okay.
So I think that if think of, you know, like how you chalk your hands and approach the bar as a magical ritual, and the spell is that you're going to make that snatch.
Okay.
And if you can believe that, there might be some performance benefits to using magic.
Okay. Yeah, I see it. All right. So this is how I differentiate between the two of them. And I'll tell you whether science or magic, where I fall on the line for that. So science to me is a method of analyzing, researching, developing a hypothesis, and testing the theory that you're trying to apply, right? So there's got to be a mode or a method of repeatability in science, right? To be able to duplicate results. So it's a scientific method almost to do a linear progression, adding 5 kilos every time to every lift every week until you can't do it anymore. Right. And then watching your progress, watching how much you grow. And so like whenever you do any kind of weightlifting cycle, the reason we keep track of all our results so we can look back and say, oh, this is what I was doing at the time. This is where I was at this point in time in my training. This is the levels and intensity of my lifts. And this is how many reps I was doing. You can go back, you can analyze all that data. There's repeatability to it. With magic, I think of it more of a force of the will. It's more of like exerting your will on the universe. And so to me, magic is just that inner thought, that inner belief that you're putting out into the universe to try to get the results that you want. So there might not, like, it could be that candle, that red flame candle, like in the bathroom with all the lights off and you're chanting and you're writing weird letters down on a piece of paper and then burning it on the candle. That could be a form of magic, but magic is also tied in with, I think, the consciousness, how we exert our conscious will on the world. And so how you approach the barbell, how you set up the routine that you do, what you tell yourself before you lift, how you feel when you hit that PR, like that's all tied in with like that magical sense of being an accomplished being.
Yeah.
Right? So
the ineffable.
Yeah, the ineffable. Like you feel colossal. Not in the sense of weight, but like just your being. Like you feel like you can achieve anything. So to me that's like a magical type of feeling. It's not necessarily repeatable, or there's not necessarily a method or specific way of always reaching that flow.
There's nothing
in sports.
Measurable.
That's
there.
What flow in sports is like. It's like magic. It's like you're in a rhythm with exactly what you're doing. You're in tune. You're in sync with the universe, with your activity. And science is more like, what can I do to repeat that state?
Yeah.
So to me, where do I fall? I actually fall right in the middle. I do believe that there is scientific ways to approach things, but I also believe that there's a little bit of like magical sense to the world. Like, is there's some things that we can't always explain that aren't always evident from the perceptions and the data that we can acquire, but they exist nonetheless.
Yeah, you know, it's I think that, you know, a little bit of magical thinking, as long as you're not, you know, trying to make, you know, government policy decisions based on it.
Yeah,
but,
you know.
Like, there is a certain level of unsatisfactoriness that people are left with an empirical worldview.
Right.
If everything is to be measured, you know what it is, but you don't know why it is. And that's why, you know, various, you know, philosophies and things like that try to kind of give some why to some of the empirical things that we can measure. And I think that if you're
well, I reckon
always in a pure empirical state, you know, you can kind of end up, you know, kind of putting yourself down a little bit. And if you can use some of that kind of awe or wonder or things that you can't actually get questions to, or you know, there's room for that.
Yeah.
And it comes down to me is, you know, this is kind of an interesting thing, is would you rather believe something that's true in a measurable sense, like empirically true?
Sure.
Or would you rather believe something useful?
Huh.
And I think that sometimes those aren't the same things.
That's true.
If you really believe that you have, you know, special alien lizard genes in your DNA that is going to allow you to deadlift 900 pounds for 10 reps, and that makes you train so hard that you do it?
Yeah.
Was it any less valuable because it wasn't true?
Right.
You know? So like sometimes, you know, if you can kind of convince yourself of these things, or, you know, use, and that's why, you know, ritual is just kind of it's placeboing yourself.
Yeah.
And if you can, you know, use your self-talk to change your thought patterns, use things like ritual or mantras or meditation and these sort of things to kind of get yourself into those states where you can do what you're physically able.
Right.
It doesn't really matter if what you believed was true as long as it was useful.
Right.
And I think that that's really weird. And you can basically think of it as, you know, you choose what you believe to suit the task that you need, right?
Yeah. Well,
so
if you need
to be Batman that day to make your lifts in the gym, be Batman that day.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you have to be Batman at dinner.
Right.
You know?
Well,
you
I liken it
at your mom's house
to being spiritual but not religious. Like, you can have this experience and experience the world in this way, but you don't have to tie it to any specific doctrine. Like, you just experience life, like, as Batman while you're lifting, and then you're not Batman when every other time.
Yeah,
so like, it's just that moment.
You don't have to. So your beliefs, as confusing as it is I find myself, you know, ask me any day of the week and my opinion or belief about something will probably be slightly different.
Right.
And it really bothers me sometimes because I'm not always super. So if you've listened to every episode of this podcast, you've probably heard me make the opposite argument about anything all the time. And it really bothers me sometimes because I don't fetishize consistency. Like, I just like wish that I was more consistent,
right.
But it really is kind of different. And if you think of your beliefs as, you know, what you believe just needs to suit the task.
Sure.
Right. And if you can really believe it and really change the way that you approach it, you can just kind of enter things with a different attitude or a different energy.
Yeah.
And that kind of can provide some tangible real world good, despite none of that being true according to physics.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. See, well, yeah. So I guess that kind of shows the science versus magic, or science or magic.
So take that, Kyle.
Yeah.
Your question was actually good.
Yeah.
All right. We got time for one more?
Yeah, we got time for one more.
Okay. So we'll finish up with Gary's question. So if you had a last meal on Earth, as if you're on death row and you get one last meal, what's your last meal?
A never-ending bowl of mac and cheese.
Mac and cheese. All right. Well, I feel like we have to unpack mac and cheese here. Are we talking boxed macaroni and cheese, baked? What kind of macaroni and cheese are we going?
Probably like baked mac and cheese.
The baked mac and cheese.
Yeah, it's just like, and the ploy is that I would get a never like one of those bottomless supplies of it, so I could just keep eating.
So okay, all right.
I'm trying to cheat the system.
Well, I mean, but what if you just eat till your stomach explodes? Then you've.
I mean, then I don't have to worry about being on death row. Then.
I mean, that's true. You eat yourself to death. What was the story? The guy who was allowed to choose his own method of execution, and he chose hanging, and then got so fat that his head would have fallen off, and that was cruel and unusual punishment, so he made it out of the death penalty.
I've never heard of that.
No? Yeah, so that's the story. Is he was allowed to choose between like firing squad, electrocution, or hanging, and he chose hanging and was on death row for a few years, so he just got as fat as he possibly could, so it would be cruel and unusual punishment to hang him.
Oh, that's pretty ingenious, actually.
I have no idea if that's true. Please don't put that into an
don't
essay.
Try that. Yeah, that's...
Fact check that.
Definitely... Definitely fact check that, but no, I could see that happening. No, I don't know. I just, if I had a last meal, I don't know. I just like so many different foods.
It's hard to
say. I mean, nothing beats like a nice medium steak with some sweet potato with a sweet potato and maybe some broccoli or something on the side.
Yeah,
that's like that's a good meal. But if I'm trying to like scheme my way into like not dying, maybe like a bottomless Red Robin's basket of french fries or something, just keep bringing them.
Yeah, I think for me, I'd probably choose like a comfort food.
Yeah.
Like, and to me, like my most comfort food is Japanese curry.
Okay.
With beef, potatoes, onions, carrots, and like that real thick yellowy Japanese curry sauce on steamed rice. And that's like that's kind of my go-to. Like if I'm having like a really hard, like if I need some comfort food, like I'll always make a big pot of the curry cubes, golden curry. And that's because like when I was a kid, that was something that my dad would make like almost every week. And like I just developed a taste for that specific like Talin, which is an Asian supermarket here.
Right.
That's not applicable to everybody, but like so getting those kind of spicy curry cubes and mixing them into essentially a stew and eating that over rice is always a go-to. Or just like a gallon of coffee ice cream.
Coffee ice cream's good too. I don't know. Well, I mean, if you're gonna consider stuff like that, like if that's the case, like I'm getting dessert too. I'm getting like butter pecan Haagen-Dazs ice cream.
There we go.
And like that's, I think my all-time favorite though is Haagen-Dazs mint chip. Like that's, if I can have that on top of my steak and sweet potato and broccoli, like I'll die a happy man.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. Yeah, Haagen-Dazs mint chip is pretty exquisite.
Yeah, it's real good.
But also, if you guys are looking for easy, like, weekday, like, make big batches of food, the golden curry cubes are actually a really awesome way to meal prep. It takes, like, 25 minutes to make a giant pot of meat and potatoes and veggies.
Okay.
And you can just dole it out throughout the week. That's a pretty good.
And so the Tallinn Market is, like, a world food market that we have here in Albuquerque. And it just has a variety of, like, different foods from around the world, like
it's
that
cool.
You wouldn't normally
down, like,
find
by country. Each
yeah,
aisle
by country.
Is a country.
Yeah,
it's pretty neat.
Yeah,
but you can even get these curry cubes in your local.
Okay, like, just go
store.
To Smith's or whatever.
Yeah, so that's
not to plug any specific store, but you know.
Yeah, that's the food hack for the week, guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do you think? We got we all wrapped up.
We can cut it short. But. I think we had a couple other questions that weren't particular to the podcast, but one of them was like, I'm visiting from out of town next week. Am I able to drop in? And because next week is Thanksgiving, we'll have shortened hours on Thanksgiving, but normally we have our set coached hours and they're on the website and all that. But if you ever want to drop in, even if you're from a local gym in town and you just want to switch up your training environment, just come hang out with us, that's totally fine. Like, drop-ins are always welcome. If you're from out of state and you need a place to train, obviously you're welcome to come train with us. And if you want to start Olympic weightlifting, you've never tried it before, never picked up a barbell, you're definitely more than welcome to come with us. We have people from the beginner level that just started, never picked up a barbell before. I just, one of our athletes brought his sister in yesterday and she had never touched a barbell, and I was just going over some basics with her. So she's learning from literally from nothing. And we have people that are going to AO finals in 2 weeks. So we have the full gamut of lifters, all ranges, and you're more than welcome to come lift with us whenever you drop in Albuquerque.
Yeah, always love to have visitors. It's fun to talk shop, get to know other people, get to know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of part of the... So if you do drop in, expect me to ask a lot of questions about what you do, because that's part of my learning process. Is I love talking to people about training and what they're up to.
Yeah, what their coaches are putting them through and the kind of, you know, things that they're doing in their Olympic weightlifting experience. And maybe there's always something that you can glean from other people's experiences in the sport.
So maybe we'll end with a little bit of weird homework. So words are just noises and we are accustomed to them, but sit down and repeat the same word 25 or 30 times. And it's going to seem like the weirdest word imaginable.
Okay.
You just say the same thing over and over again. Chair, 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 chair. I'll just do it for a minute straight, and you'll start to lose any association of what that noise is with what the object you usually associate it with.
Interesting.
Okay. And it starts to just become this really bizarre noise that you're making. So that's weird. I don't know.
No, that's a good... Because, like, yeah, because our mind associates... As we grow older, we associate a word with an object, right? But we've been taught to associate a word with that object. So there's always that link between the hemisphere of the brain that fosters language and the one that fosters like visual imagery and creativity and things like that. So that corpus callosum that connects both sides of the left and right brain, you're messing with that when you're doing an exercise like that.
Yeah.
And so you're just associating one from the other.
And it's kind of a fun... way to just point out how just subtly changing little inputs like that can radically shift your perception of things.
Right.
And, you know, because anytime that you see a word over and over again, like it just starts to lose its meaning, right? Because it's just this repeated phrase. And it allows you to kind of take a look at, oh man, that's how important language is.
Yeah.
Like the words that are in your head are what shapes how you view reality.
Right.
And just like the true belief be or useful belief, right? None of the like language isn't a truth, right? Okay. Trees aren't called trees. That's just our description of trees.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Trees don't have a name. They're trees. They don't use language.
Right.
So if you can kind of start to look at, you know, what words you choose to think with, you know, trying to shape the way that your thoughts emerge, shape the way that you speak to other people, it can radically change your experience of the world just by shifting what sort of language you're using in your day-to-day life. So if you're an I can't person, just shifting that to, you know, anything else, really.
Yeah.
If it's that. But, you know, so trying to subtly change the words that you use to describe yourself, to describe your surroundings. Try to look at things and say, that's beautiful more often. And you'll have a way better day.
Yeah.
Like, if you're just driving, like, take notice of something. Stop what you're doing and just look at a tree for 5 minutes. Try to just focus on that and notice as much as you can about it. And you'll see that it's super weird.
Yeah.
Like, really paying attention to something, like, minute. I caught myself just watching a spider come down on a web.
Okay.
On my porch, and I just stayed there for like 5 minutes, and I learned a lot of new things about how spiders move around. I'd never really paid attention.
Okay.
So there's all kinds of weird, mysterious stuff that is just glossed over the same way that we always associate the same word all the time.
Right.
And if you kind of take that step and you try to look at something in detail, what can you learn? What can you notice just by observing?
Hmm.
And I feel like we always just kind of rush through our day, rush That's through our true. World. Take 2 minutes to just watch ants collect stuff and see what you can notice. You know, it can be anything. If you put your attention on anything in enough detail, it starts to become really alien, huh. and you can pick up some new information.
Yeah, it turns into like, what do I really know about the world around me?
Yeah,
like,
how much am I taking for granted?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some weird homework for you.
I felt like that with coding. I had this thought a couple of weeks ago about coding, and like the world is built on these structures of things that people create, like apps and computer programs, and everything that you use on a daily basis has computer coding. That means somebody put work behind it. Somebody built this thing to do what it does. And the world is being shaped by people that know how to do this. But if you don't understand anything about it, it could just seem like magic. So it's like that science and magic thing all over again. It's just like there's a science behind coding and computer programming languages and assembly language and all the things that make the things in the background work. You know, every time you pick up your phone. But somebody put in work to make that happen. So it's not just magic. Somebody's actually doing something to contribute to your ability to do these things. So that's something interesting to think about too. And it goes along with the lines of like being appreciative and grateful for the things that exist around you, in and around your life.
Yeah, all the invisible things that you don't really notice, that you take for granted.
Yeah,
you realize that the more of those things that you look at, you're just utterly ignorant about almost everything.
Right. All right, folks. Well, that concludes our Q&A for today. Like I said, we'll have another episode for you concerning volume and maybe that same subject that we breached along with volume. But yeah, we appreciate the questions. Keep sending them. We'll probably do this again. And we do appreciate you guys taking the time to ask us some stuff. Even if it seems silly, we'll still turn it into something significant. So.
All right, guys. Well, have a great week. Again, please subscribe to the podcast, and we'll see everybody next week.
All right. Until next time, live with no regrets, y'all.